This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on confiscation and asset recovery. I am joined by Senior Barrister Gary Pons from 5 St Andrews Hill Chambers in London. Gary is a specialist in the field of business and financial crime. He is one of the leading legal experts on the enforcement of confiscation orders. Gary's business crime and white-collar crime work dovetail with his asset recovery, confiscation and civil fraud work, which often involves technical points of law and financial detail. He is ranked in the Legal 500 and Chambers and Partners for his work in POCA and asset recovery and forfeiture. Thank you so much for joining me, Gary.
It's a pleasure, Hattie. How are you?
I'm trying not to stumble over my words, but apart from that, it's been a long day. Up at 4:15 this morning, as I mentioned, and I just want to say that because I need to just feel a little bit sorry for myself for getting up at that beautiful hour. But apart from that, we're here to discuss a serious area of law, and I'm pleased that we are because I was only just telling Gary, actually, before we pressed record, that out of over 109 episodes that we have released, his podcast that we recorded last year in June on financial crime, account forfeiture and freezing orders, part one, is the most listened to podcast that we have.
Fantastic.
And I'm smiling, but he's being all professional on the other side of Zoom and keeping that poker face. But yes, so the Home Office Statistical Bulletin reported that as at March 2020, £139 million was collected as confiscation orders, £69 million was collected through forfeitures in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. So our conversation today will largely cover the Proceeds of Crime Act 2002, also referred to as POCA. Gary, tell us, what do we mean by confiscation and asset recovery, please?
Okay, well, let me deal with confiscation first. Confiscation refers to proceedings that are conducted after a person has been convicted of a criminal offence. So that their purpose or what they're designed for is to ensure the recovery of what that offender has obtained by committing his criminal offences. And the way in which it does that is it places a monetary value on what they've obtained. So it values their gains from committing criminal offences and then makes a order, a confiscation order, that simply requires them to pay back either an amount that is equivalent to what they have obtained through committing crime, or if they don't have assets to that value, and to the lesser amount that their assets value. That's quite a mouthful, but that's what confiscation is. Asset recovery is a more general term that covers all areas of obtaining back from criminals what they have obtained by committing their criminal offences. So it also covers civil wrongs, and it looks upon the more general recovery of assets, whereas confiscation is a specific subpart of asset recovery.
Interesting stuff. I mean, the government's overarching aim is to cut crime when it talks about asset recovery and the way it's used to try and reduce crime. And, you know, there's a number of operational bodies across the criminal justice system that are responsible for investigating and prosecuting and enforcing asset recovery. But tell us about your work. What does your work involve in that area of law?
Okay, well, I act for prosecuting authorities. are often, but not exclusively, dealing with the enforcement of confiscation orders, as you introduce to the listeners when you introduce me. And as I said, a confiscation order is an order to pay a sum of money. And so if it isn't actually paid, then the debt that that confiscation order represents needs to be enforced. Often that is done, but not always, by appointing a receiver. And the receiver will take possession of the offender's assets. And I often act for those receivers in their efforts to get the offender's assets and to sell them. I also act for both enforcement authorities and respondents in civil recovery proceedings. Those are a different part of the proceeds of crime that we'll talk about, I suspect, in a moment, dealing with non-conviction-based asset recovery. They're freestanding non-conviction proceedings, and the focus in those proceedings is on the property itself and actually proving that the property has been obtained by or in return for unlawful conduct. I also act for judgment creditors in civil proceedings who need to enforce their judgment against the assets of a defendant. So that's a very broad outline of the kind of work that I do in this field.
Interesting. And this is what I was going to ask you next, in terms of civil and criminal asset recovery. Can we talk about the differences there, and what we mean by criminal confiscation and civil proceedings and forfeiture? Can you just talk us through that, please?
All right. I would say that there are basically three types of asset recovery. The first is regulated by Part 2 of the Proceeds of Crime Act, and those really are confiscation orders, although Part 2 deals with what happens before confiscation orders, so restraint orders, which enable prosecuting authorities to prevent the dissipation of assets, similar to a freezing order in civil proceedings. And it also deals with the appointment of a receiver and other methods to enforce non-payment of confiscation orders. But Part 2 deals with conviction-based asset recovery. The confiscation only occurs, principally occurs, once a defendant has been convicted of a criminal offence from which he or she has obtained some kind of financial benefit. The second part is regulated by Part 5 of the Proceeds of Crime Act. This isn't really criminal asset recovery because there are no criminal charges that are brought. There's no conviction. These are freestanding civil proceedings that are brought in respect of property. And as I said a moment ago, what needs to be proved to the civil standard of proof, but on the balance of probabilities, is that the property, which can be watches, it can be gold, and it can be cash, or it can be real property, so such as people with houses, that those were obtained, and to say, to use a statutory test, by or in return for unlawful conduct. In other words, that they actually are the proceeds of crime. So it looks at those particular assets and how they have been obtained, often involving a tracing exercise. So those are Part 5. And then in relation to civil asset recovery, that's quite a wide area in itself, because it can include the entire effort by the victim of, for example, a civil wrong, it would amount to a crime if it were prosecuted, to trace his or her assets, to identify the wrongdoer, to identify what proceedings can be brought, and to obtain the right judgment, and then to enforce that judgment either against the offender or against their assets. So that, I think, is a very broad outline as to what I would say there are three types of asset recovery.
Thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is when I think about sort of crime and fraud and confiscation, and when I think about forfeiture, I always naturally relate it to criminal proceedings. I think, well, that has to be a crime. So when we talk about civil proceedings that don't require a conviction for confiscation or forfeiture, I just think, well, in what circumstances would that happen? Could we, Is it? Are there any circumstances you can give us an example of where in civil proceedings, where a conviction is not required, asset recovery, or is it forfeiture, or is it confiscation? Which one would apply? Which one is most commonly applied, would you say?
In relation to non-conviction-based cases, there are three different types of proceedings that can be brought in the magistrate's court. Okay, the first relates to cash, which requires that cash has been seized, and then you can bring cash forfeiture applications in respect of the cash. Those are really asset recovery proceedings. They are an application by which, if, say, it's the police, if they're able to prove on the balance of probabilities that the cash has been obtained through criminal conduct, then the result of that is the cash is forfeited and it gets paid to the Treasury. Another example are listed assets. Listed assets can include gold, they can include watches. There are other things, but
or
those
valuable
are
paintings or expensive cars or things like that.
Exactly. At the moment, there are a lot of applications in relation to watches, because you can imagine that high value watches.
Wow.
Because of their value and because of their size, they're an interesting commodity to deal with if you're dealing with the proceeds of crime. And then the third is what we've spoken about before on these podcasts, is asset freezing and forfeiture orders, which are applications that are brought in the magistrate's court in relation to monies held in bank accounts. So those are three examples, all in the magistrate's court, of non-conviction based applications in respect of property. In the High Court, there are the civil recovery proceedings, so the first part of Part 5. Those frequently relate to property, real property, and houses. And those proceedings have been brought ever since the Proceeds of Crime Act came into force, initially by the Asset Recovery Agency and then by the Serious and Organised Crime Agency and now by the NCA. And there's a whole list of them, although the reality is that when you number the cases over a period of time, there aren't actually that many. They've frequently attracted Court of Appeal attention because of the nature of the proceedings. As you pointed out, they're unusual, because what you're trying to do is, the objective is to ensure that property that's owned by a person is effectively taken away from them and title to that property is vested in the state. It's unusual, and it's proceedings that are not replicated throughout Europe, for example. Some countries have similar non-conviction-based asset recovery regimes, but other countries don't.
Interesting stuff. I mean, it's not a topic that's widely spoken about, and I have to say, you know, just coming back to absolute basics, most people, and certainly a lot of my knowledge on this topic, came from watching films. And then it's not even actually how it rolls out, because the films are films. You know, the majority of them are fiction. And, you know, what we know is simply from watching those sorts of things rather than having a knowledge of this area of law. But let's talk about your work a little bit more. Can we talk about a case in which you have represented a body or a person, and without naming names, where there was a successful asset recovery following a confiscation order?
Right, so I'll focus on a confiscation case. And to put into context what I'm about to tell you, it should be apparent that there is a massive gulf between confiscation orders themselves and payment of confiscation orders. It's one of the biggest problem. The confiscation order, an order from a court, really is just a piece of paper saying that the defendant owes the court a certain amount of money. But unless they actually pay it, the confiscation order itself doesn't really achieve its means.
So enforcement of the order is the biggest issue, you're saying, or one of the big issues in this area of law.
It's one of the issues, because there are certain types of defendants who are perfectly prepared to pay voluntarily. And if they don't pay voluntarily, there is a default sentence, which in certain circumstances is activated by the magistrate's court, which serves as an incentive to pay. That doesn't affect all defendants. So let me give you some figures to return the figures that you started off the podcast with. So Her Majesty's Court Service Trust issued a statement in 2018 for the 2018-2019 period. And what it said was the outstanding confiscation order debt at that stage stood at over $2 billion. Which you may think is a staggeringly large
figure. That is literally, we're talking about £2 billion was ordered to be paid, but not, i.e. the word outstanding. £2 billion. Whoa.
Yeah, £2 billion.
Big bucks.
£2
billion. Big bucks.
And there are many, many reasons why that is. And if people want to examine those reasons, the easiest place to look for some of the factors that contribute to that is the Law Commission's consultation report on the reform of Part 2 of the Proceeds of Crime Act. So,
Now I know why you started this this bit of our conversation by saying that there is there are issues with enforcement, and that's probably a challenge in itself. Once an order has been made, it doesn't mean the payment is guaranteed to be received or paid.
Right, exactly. So the reason why I introduced it in that way is because the example I'm going to give you is not an example that's got particularly high figures, and also because when it comes to understanding the process, the part that I play in the process involves certain applications that need to be made. And so I don't always see precisely how a confiscation order is paid. If you've got a large confiscation order that's paid by a defendant voluntarily, the reality is I'm not going to know about that. I only become involved in the cases that are more problematic and that require some kind of enforcement action. So that's the reason why I introduced it. So let me give you an example then. The case that I was involved in involved a confiscation order being made in 2014. Okay, the sum was just under £80,000, which, whilst not insignificant, is a relatively modest
figure.
It's a decent sum. Yeah, it's a relative modest figure compared to what confiscation orders can be. The underlying criminal activity was unfair trading, okay? And that was a confiscation order that the defendant did not pay, probably, in fact, had no intention of ever paying, okay? And what happened in this case was that a receiver was appointed, and the effect of that is that the court appoints the receiver really to do the court's job, because the court is the payee, the judgment creditor, if you like, but the court's not going to take active steps to enforce its own judgment. So what it does is it appoints a receiver, and it appoints the receiver in such a way that the receiver takes possession of all of the defendant's assets. The statutory term is realizable property. And so once the receiver has it at law, he then, in this case she, can deal with all of the defendant's property, which all sounds well, in theory, but of course, some defendants don't cooperate with the receivership order either. So a receivership order frequently contains a requirement that if it relates to a domestic property, that property is given, the possession of it is given over to the receiver. Of course, in this case, and in other cases, that didn't happen. And so the next step was to enforce the receivership order by applying for permission to issue a writ of possession, which is effectively sending the High Court bailiffs in. And that's where I became involved, making that application. In this case, the application was granted, but then there was an appeal against that application.
But how can there be an appeal against the application if the court order has already been made for the confiscation? That I don't get that bit.
Well, it was an appeal against the issue of the writ of possession rather than anything else. So the permission to issue the writ, that was granted by a master. And because it's granted by a master, there is a right to appeal to a High Court judge. And that's what happened. The appeal was dismissed. But the long and short of it all was that the property wasn't sold because there were other practical issues until September 2017. Then the confiscation order was paid. This confiscation order had a compensation order, so it was designed to ensure that the victims of the unfair trading received back what they had lost. But if you think about the process and how long it had taken...
3 years.
Depending on the and 3 years is from the confiscation order. Of course, the loss to the victims of the case preceded even that. But that was a case where, by taking those actions, which included a receivership order and then enforcement of the receivership order, we were able to ensure that the confiscation order was paid. So in that case, it was a successful asset recovery. But it serves to, I think, highlight two important points. One, that it's important that no one ever takes for granted payment of a confiscation order. And two, it can be really, really difficult to ensure that payment occurs. And then this is a case where there was a default term. The fact that there's a default term hanging over a defendant's head doesn't necessarily achieve, in and of itself, payment of the confiscation order.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is going to be a really simple question based on the way you've just wonderfully delivered the details of that case. If somebody has got a confiscation order made against them and they default, if they have not been imprisoned for their actions, would there necessarily be a imprisonment kind of default position of imprisonment if they don't pay? Is that common?
I think the easiest way to explain it is this. Once the confiscation order is made, it is made with a default term. It has to. So every single confiscation order has a term of imprisonment in default. Okay. But in terms of how that term of imprisonment is activated, well, that's a matter for the magistrates' court. And so there are typically enforcement hearings at the magistrates' court where the magistrates will consider whether or not someone is willfully refusing to pay, or whether there is culpable neglect on their behalf. Okay, they'll weigh up those things in deciding whether or not the state has come to activate the default term, effectively weighing up, is this person going to pay the order? What are they doing to realise their assets? Has the time come for us to draw a line under all the other options because they're plainly not going to pay, they're willfully neglecting to pay, and so we will then impose the default term. So that's kind of the way that it operates in practice. But if someone does serve the default term, it doesn't remove the obligation to pay the confiscation order. It's not an either or. You serve the default term, which, as you can imagine, in some cases can be years, but you still owe the confiscation order. So it really is, its principal purpose is to ensure that a defendant pays. Some people, let me ask you, Gary, on that point,
so when confiscation orders are being made, and now I'm obviously talking very, very generically, and I can appreciate that each case is very unique and independent to its own merits and information. Does the court necessarily make confiscation orders based on what it can see it can recover? For example, if a court says, you, Mr. A, owe £1 million, but Mr. A just doesn't have £1 million to pay, but that just happens to be what they have to repay because what they perhaps earned out of the something that was wrongfully done, financially wrongfully done, or wrongfully obtained through criminal means and, you know, proceeds of crime and all sorts of things. Is the court likely to order what it knows it can get back, or is it likely to put an order, a figure on something, should I say, for repayment based on what the damages are?
Right. So the short answer is it's neither of those things.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. The way it approaches it is this. So it is essentially two stages. The first is it places a value on what a defendant has obtained through committing crime. So a value on a defendant's criminal conduct, okay? And let's, for an example, say that in a specific example, a defendant has obtained £1 million through fraud. Okay, let's keep the fraud generic. Okay, so the starting point is that under the Proceeds of Crime Act, having assessed that a defendant has benefited the figure of £1 million, the starting point is the defendant will pay back £1 million. And that, as a matter of pure logic, achieves asset recovery. He has had taken away from him what he had gotten by committing his criminal offences. But no one can be ordered to pay what they do not have. And of course, you can't receive a default term in respect of an assessment that is made to pay an order when at the time the confiscation order is made, you cannot afford to make it. So the second step is an assessment by the court of the value of a defendant's property at the time of the hearing. So that would include a market value on their interest in any property, including the
valuations of goods, high value goods or value goods over exactly. a certain amount. Right.
Yeah. So it places a value on a person's assets, all of their assets at that time. And if you're looking at debts, for example, if someone is owed money, that is an asset, unless it is an irrecoverable debt, in which case it is an asset that has no value. But the whole system works upon placing a value at the time of the confiscation hearing on what a person owns. And then what should happen thereafter is that that property is realised and used to pay a confiscation order. Obviously, as a matter of logic, the greater the time between valuation and realisation, the more fluctuation there can be in value.
I mean, the reason... Sorry, Gary, the reason why I asked that question is because when we're talking about £2 billion is outstanding to be paid based on confiscation orders that have been made, you kind of think, well, obviously each one is, as I said, very individual, but why is there so much money outstanding if confiscation orders are being made based on, okay, what was actually lost, what was gained by the criminal act, for example, and what was lost by whoever lost those funds, and the ability to be able to pay it back. And if we're saying that the courts evaluate what the assets of the person or persons or company that committed these wrongs and these essentially this crime, then why is there £2 billion outstanding? There's no short answer to that, is there really?
There is no short answer to that, and that's why I was directing everyone's attention to the Law Commission report, which deals with it in detail. There are a number of causes, each of which requires detailed consideration and explanation. Some of these you're dealing with professional criminals who've got no intention of paying. The entire purpose of committing the offence in the first place is to make sure that they obtain their property, and they've taken steps to conceal it to such an extent that recovery is difficult, if not impossible. So using other jurisdictions where enforcement of a UK confiscation order is difficult, that's one factor. The other factor is passage of time. The other factor is the extent to which at the beginning of 2003, 2004, when confiscation orders were first made, were they made in the same way that they would be made now. A number of higher court decisions, Supreme Court and House of Lords decisions, have changed the approach that's taken to confiscation orders. It may well be that that's resulted in a confiscation order being made back then higher than it would be now. Difficult to say without knowing the specifics of any one case, but as a generality, those are part of the reasons why it is. But obviously, in straitened times, something that is worth bearing in mind, because £2 billion is a lot of money. But the real question is the extent to which that is recoverable, the extent to which, even worse, sustained and concerted efforts made, how much would be recoverable? And to quote the same Her Majesty's Court Service Trust statement, of that £2 billion, their calculation is only £161 million is collectible. So they think
the rest is basically a written off. Yeah, will have to be written off, or will be written off. Wow. Yeah,
how they calculate that, I don't know. But their assessment is that's how much they can actually collect through concerted enforcement. That gives you an idea of the issues and the problems that exist in this.
And the scale of it. You know, these are massive, massive numbers. And this is an incredibly interesting area of law. I find it fascinating. And I think what we'll have to do in a part two...
Patty, it's always nice to not bore people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But what we'll have to, which is why I was going to say, what we'll have to do in a part two is delve deeper into some of the cases that you have done, again, without naming names and confidentiality, protecting confidentiality and all of that, and getting some nitty gritty, juicy details. But Gary, today, that's all we've got time for.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being my guest today. And what I'd like to say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.